policy, not public health, on health policy. Half of our group is still in caucus. There is a party caucus going on as we speak, and so that's why half of us are not here. I think this is a great opportunity to hear a point of view that we may not often hear in committee. We have invited a number of people to come and testify who are from citizen groups, and we value your input. And so we have six individuals to testify. We'd like to take about 10 minutes each, and we will interrupt with questions as they occur. And so, Ellen, would you like to come up, please? Should we call three? Okay, Ellen, Elizabeth Beyer, and Ellen Gradison, would you all come up, please? Okay, Ellen Penny, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, Senator Morissette. For the record, my name's Ellen Penny. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Health Action Campaign. Senator Walker, Senator Morissette, I'm so glad that you are here to hear the consumer perspective on the Oregon health plan.
Thank you.
Really appreciate this opportunity.
You being here.
The Oregon Health Action Campaign is a coalition of individuals and organizations committed to empowering the consumer voice in the development of health systems that give all people access to the care they need when they need it from providers of their choice at an affordable cost. We have a number of projects housed within our coalition, including the Campaign for Patients' Rights Expanded Access Coalition, which has recently received the Covering Kids and Families Grant Award from Robert Wood Johnson to reach out to and enroll eligible uninsured Oregon children and families into Oregon's health programs. The Campaign for Patients' Rights, Project Equality, who you're going to hear from here soon, run by and for people on the Oregon Health Plan. We were active in the development of the Oregon Health Plan in 1989 and throughout its implementation. We worked most diligently on the requirement that all employers contribute to health care for their workers and dependents. The Oregon Health Plan was never intended to be a public-only funded plan. It was always intended to be a public-private partnership. We worked hard on making a connection in the benefits provided to OHP enrollees and people in the private insurance market, which is now evident in something called the standard plan provided in the private insurance market. Again, the Oregon Health Plan was never intended to be a benefits experiment only for the poor. We worked hard on ensuring an open public process for plan and benefit development. We were unsuccessful in our efforts to link the benefits provided to OHP enrollees with the benefits provided to state legislatures. And we were unsuccessful in 1989 Senate Bill 27 in ensuring that below a certain level there is no point in moving the line any further, that there is in fact a package of benefits that is the bottom line. In Oregon now we have gone well below that bottom line for one-third of OHP enrollees. Oregon Health Plan was important to members of our coalition for other reasons. It delinked welfare from health care. We believe health care is a right. We assumed that the delinking would simplify enrollment, and we were hopeful that it would reduce the stigma attached to welfare. The Oregon Health Plan made access to publicly funded health programs a right for everyone with incomes below the federal poverty level. It held out the promise of universal coverage. It promised to pay providers at cost. It would eliminate the cost shift, of caring for the uninsured to the private market, the cost shift from under-reimbursed providers to the private market, the cost shift of unmet health needs to our education, criminal, and juvenile justice systems. As the benefits list developed, we were very pleased to see a clear statement that prevention is the single most important benefit money can buy, and that mental health cannot be separated from physical health. Our initial concern about the Oregon Health Plan was the prioritized list of benefits, that it might be used to deny high-cost services to the few that need them. We learned early on in the Oregon Health Plan implementation, however, that that was not the biggest problem for enrollees. The biggest problem pre-1989 and to date remains access. access to the few providers who actually accept cards, access to the program itself. The application process is an enormous barrier. Access to services when you are asked to pay copays and premiums you cannot afford. Access challenges faced by enrollees as their plans and providers turn in and out of the Oregon Health Plan, and they themselves turn in and out of eligibility potentially every 6 months. And now, access to services that are desperately needed and no longer funded. In order to understand how to improve the Oregon Health Plan, it's important to understand who's enrolled in it and the services each receives from and relies on. We've attached a December snapshot in time. It's a long page, looks like this, attached to your testimony, that divides enrollees by category of eligibility. Other people who will be testifying after me and myself can answer any questions you have about that chart. Basically, there's 420,000 Oregon Health Plan enrollees. They're aged, blind, disabled, and TANF populations who are known as categorical eligibles, CHIP children, the medically needy, and the population known as the expanded population or OHP standard. The bottom line, and I actually had some capitation rates, costs for these various enrollees, which I can provide to you. I left them in my car. But the bottom line is when you have a health condition that requires treatment, you cost money. If you are a kid, you are cheap. In all cases, Oregon Health Plan, for what it provides, is much cheaper than similar packages that could be available on the private market. The population of Oregon Health Plan recipients this chart does not show are enrollees in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which draws down both state and federal money to enroll people in private market products. FEHAP is very much a part and parcel of the Oregon Health Plan, as is the high-risk pool, as is the insurance reforms that came along with its launching in 1989 and subsequently. All were part of the overall vision to basically move Oregon towards universal coverage. FEHAP now focuses its efforts, and we believe should exclusively focus its efforts, on workers and their dependents eligible but unable to afford premiums for employer-provided health care. This, of course, implies people with higher income levels than most in the Oregon Health Plan standard population. This chart also does not reveal information vital to the success of any efforts to restructure the Oregon Health Plan. 40% of the people in the standard population live with incomes less than 10% of the federal poverty level. These are people, as you realize, who have just lost their mental health, prescription drug, chemical dependency services, who are being asked to pay premiums and who are being asked to pay copays for the services that they get. I've attached a federal poverty level chart so that you can hopefully keep in mind what it means to live at the federal poverty level in a family of four. You are making $1,533 a month. If you are a single person making 10% of the federal poverty level, you're living with basically $74 a month. And according to the information those of us who served on the waiver application steering committee received, again, that is 40% of the enrollees in the OHP standard plan. Much has been made of rebuilding the Oregon Health Plan to make it look like private market. Like the private market, I submit to you that the majority of Oregon Health Plan enrollees, including those in the standard plan, are not best served by private market lookalike products. It's also important to understand who's not enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. There are 423,000 uninsured Oregonians. The vast majority of them work full or part-time or live in families where someone in the household works full or part-time. The vast majority live with incomes less than 250% of the poverty level. This is no surprise if you look at what 250% of the federal poverty level is and you look at the cost of insurance products on the private market, you'll recognize why people cannot afford coverage. There are 150,000 people who are estimated to be eligible for but unenrolled in one of Oregon's health programs. Over 100,000 children are uninsured in this state. In addition, and as subsets, Oregon's uninsured include adults with liquid assets of more than $2,000. Despite their income being below poverty, if they have more than $2,000, they cannot enroll. Children living in families with liquid assets of more than $5,000. People unable to afford their premiums or people who owe past due premiums cannot enroll in the Oregon Health Plan now for 6 months. There are people who do not enroll in the Oregon Health Plan because the paperwork and enrollment process is intimidating at best. I have actually here an application for the Oregon Health Plan. I'm going to turn it over to Elizabeth to talk to you about because I don't want to use my time on that. But it's really important for this committee, I think, to understand what it takes for somebody who is eligible to enroll in this program. Literacy is an enormous barrier to accessing this program, which has one of the more complicated application processes in this country. You recognize, I'm sure, that 50% of the people in this country read and write at an eighth grade level or less, and among this population, the literacy rate is much lower. There are people not enrolled in this program who cycle in and out of seasonal jobs and temporary jobs who cannot find that perfect window of opportunity where their three-month average comes out to less than the federal poverty level. And there are people who have not, including children, who have not been uninsured for 6 months. You all know that in order to enroll, you have to be uninsured for 6 months. We submit that maximizing enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan is good not only for the health and well-being of its enrollees, it's good for Oregon's economy. On average, every Medicaid dollar we spend as a state brings $1.50 back into Oregon. Every CHIP dollar we spend brings in $2.57. Oregon has over 171 million federal CHIP dollars waiting for us to draw down to come up with some state money to draw down that federal match. According to a recent Families USA report, which I've attached to my testimony, for every dollar Oregon cuts in its Medicaid program, $1 million Oregon cuts in its Medicaid program, we lose 32 jobs, $3 million in business activity, and 1.1 million in revenue-generating employee wages. Conversely, of course, every $1 million we add would bring those jobs, that new revenue, and increased business activity back into the state. The recent $25.7 million cuts in the Oregon Health Plan thus translate to a loss of 822 jobs, $77 million in business activity, and $28 million in revenue-generating wages. This is not the time to be seeking additional and more creative ways of cutting the Medicaid Oregon Health Plan budget. It is time to find the resolve to raise the funds necessary to support it and draw down the federal match that comes with it. An economic stimulus for the state in and of itself, even without the jobs and additional revenue it creates. We urge you to build that resolve in yourself, within your communities, and within these halls. Use that resolve to drive collective action not only on raising state revenues, but to lobby at the federal level for what the federal government can provide us that would help in our budget shortfall. That is, to ask the federal government to increase the federal match rate and to ask the federal government to include drugs in Medicare. I think probably most of you know that for many people on the medically needy program who have lost access to their prescriptions, if Medicare were to cover prescription drugs, they would not be facing the choices they're facing now. The suggestions we have for improving the Oregon Health Plan are based on the following assumptions. It's healthy for Oregon's economy and the people who live here to maximize the health of all people. Access to services starting with prevention is essential for Oregon Health Plan enrollees. Enrollment for those eligible should be straightforward and simple. I would point to Wyoming, which had a process very similar to Oregon's for enrolling its children in the CHIP program. Some 16 pages, lots of backup documentation required. They ran the numbers, found that it was not saving them as much money as it would cost them to enroll eligible children. They went to a one-page application with very little documentation required for their children. Turning in and out of coverage and plans is not cost-effective. If Oregon does not pay upfront for health services, we pay in the end in ways that are much more costly to the health and well-being of people living in this state. If you work together to expand the pool of Oregon health plan enrollees, we believe that will increase provider participation and lower per capita costs. Based on those assumptions, I would offer the following suggestions for Oregon health plan improvement. There should be no premiums for people living in poverty. If premiums are to be continued, there should be exemptions maintained for victims of domestic violence, for people who are homeless, and for people living with zero incomes. Basically, by charging those people premiums, you deny them access to this plan. There should be no co-payments for people living in poverty. If co-pays are to be included, there should be a maximum monthly limit on the amount paid by each family. I would ask that in your efforts to look at the Oregon Health Plan, you recognize the cost that families incur when they are sent to collections for medical bills that they cannot pay. The six-month uninsurance waiting requirement should be reduced. It should be waived for people who are laid off because of no fault of their own and for people locked into private market plans that do not meet their children's needs. OHAC believes that Oregon should follow the lead of many states and eliminate the assets test for children. Other than assets tests for children, the liquid assets test, the access point and enrollment period should be uniform across all programs, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, Oregon Health Plan, and CHIP. There should be one toll-free number. There should be one application. There should be 1 year continuous enrollment for all enrollees, a $10,000 liquid assets test for all programs. This would lead to administrative simplicity and ease of enrollment and retention of people eligible. The Oregon Health Plan should remain an entitlement for people living below the poverty level. The medically needy program should be reinstated. If we cannot go to a simplified, basically 1 year continuous eligibility, we should at least look at a simplified 6 month renewal process. Currently, many Oregon Health Plan enrollees fall off the Oregon Health Plan because their reapplication process is exactly like their application process, and we lose many people in that transition. A 6 month completely new re-enrollment process generates unnecessary paperwork, churning, and barriers. Many states are going to internet applications. Doctors and all primary care providers absolutely have to be reimbursed at cost. Not being able to find a provider when you are enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan is one reason people choose not to re-enroll, and I would suggest also violates the intent of the Oregon Health Plan. Any family unable to pay premium, any adult unable to pay premium who has children needs to be informed very plainly that their children remain eligible. There are no premium contributions for children. We have heard that as many as 70% of the OHP standard population will fall out of coverage because of recent changes to the Oregon Health Plan. It is vital that they are informed that their children remain eligible for these programs. The results of Oregon's evidence-based drug research should be widely advertised to all doctors and patients as tools for improving access to the most cost-effective medications. The safety net needs to be supported, encouraged, and expanded, as should any delivery system that offers 24-hour multilingual advice nurse access. I would suggest that having advice nurses available to my own family has reduced the cost of my insurance to my insurance plan drastically. That there be worker-friendly hours of operation, that there should be community access or at least access to delivery systems along major transportation routes, and the ability for drop-in urgent care visits without weeks in advance appointments. I would suggest that that would be one way of lowering unnecessary hospital emergency room utilization. Enrollees who are required to choose a managed care plan should have immediate and easy access to information about providers in those plans who are open and accepting new patients. We ask them to make these choices without that information at this time. It does not result in, I think, the delivery and provider-patient relationship models that we would like to encourage as a state. In places where enrollees do not have access to managed care plans, the prescription drug copayment requirement should be eliminated. It is discriminatory. It hits hardest on those living in parts of the state where there is no managed care, and on those who need mental health services. As you all know, the mental health services, mental health prescriptions are carved out of managed care contracts. The state should do all it can, and plans that contract, the few remaining plans that contract to provide services to this population, should do all that it can to encourage and nurture ways of teaching Oregon health plan enrollees how to utilize the system and where they can go for help. Again, we believe this would decrease unnecessary emergency room utilization. This process should start with Oregon health plan enrollees with chronic health conditions. We would ask this committee to continue ensuring that the voice of the Oregon Health Plan enrollees and those that serve their needs is heard in every step of the process that rewrites the Oregon Health Plan. If you build a system without their input, it will not work. We appreciate, again, this opportunity to be before you today. We would ask your acknowledgement that the private insurance model does not work well for people living in poverty. We would ask that you not invest public dollars in health insurance plans that do not meet the benefit needs, out-of-pocket cost limitations, and have underwriting criteria that basically serve to deny access for pre-existing conditions. That's why we do not support public money being used through FEOP on individual market products. We ask that you reinstate the prescription drug and mental health services for Oregon Health Plan enrollees. We ask that you hold on to retroactive eligibility. It is one of the best tools outreach and enrollment workers have for enrolling those eligible, currently uninsured, into the Oregon Health Plan. We ask that you do all within your power to draw down federal CHIP money to cover all uninsured Oregon children. That you research and take action to secure contributions from Oregon's employers with a large number of employees enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. And finally, we would ask that you reconsider how enrollees find out or how enrollees get information about their enrollment, which is currently on a big 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper with lots of conflicting and confusing information. And I'm sure that Project Equality can share more with you about that. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Do you have a fiscal impact on this?
Well, thank you for asking that, Chair Morissette. I hope that, if nothing else, my testimony has suggested that the fiscal impact of actually funding this program using state dollars needs to be weighed against the jobs that Medicaid creates in this state and the reduction of cost shift to other programs, including education in the criminal and juvenile justice system. And I would say that I have yet to see an analysis, a fiscal analysis, that incorporates all of the pieces that we believe need to be considered as you think about.
No, what I will do, because I do sit on the work group that meets on the Oregon Health Plan on Monday and Wednesday evenings, and we met, Alan Lowe was with us last night, and we did, I think we've had our third meeting. Actually, maybe we had our fifth meeting because I didn't attend the first two. We have stakeholders who are involved in providing services who are there. I think Ellen represents the consumers. And what I will do is forward some of your suggestions, and I guess I would be interested in a prioritized, or maybe I'll talk with you some more about, you know, narrow it down to some things that you think, you know, I'd like you to narrow your list perhaps so I could give this to the body that's meeting and ask them to seriously consider some of your recommendations, knowing that, you know, the funds are limited. I'm not sure where we're going with this. I'm not sure what the solutions will be. So far, there haven't been any. We're operating under some very tight restrictions in terms of money that we have to work with, trying to buy back some vital services, reduce services in other places. So far, there has been no discussion of increased revenue. So we're not talking about that so far, but I think at some point we may get to that. But I would appreciate, though, some additional refinement of your suggestions, and I will certainly forward them to the group.
Chair Morrison, I thank you for that opportunity.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Chair Senator Morissette and members of the Senate Healthcare Committee. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Elizabeth Byers. I live in West Salem, and I'm here representing the consumer perspective on the Oregon Health Plan. I'm qualified to provide the consumer perspective on the Oregon Health Plan because of my work with Project Equality, a consumer group of people on the Oregon Health Plan, and the Mental Health Association of Oregon. Both organizations represent and thousands of people who benefit from Medicaid-funded programs. I can tell you first that so many people on the Oregon Health Plan are working Oregonians. Right now, they're in very difficult straits because they're not able to afford their meds and the mental health services that make it possible for them to continue to work. This is going to quickly become not only a public health issue, but a public safety issue. We'd like to make one first suggestion that if we raise the Oregon Health Plan eligibility for income up to 300% of federal poverty level, our Medicaid match rate will be enhanced because we're covering a greater percentage of our population. And at 30% of federal poverty level, those employers would be able to receive some remedy for the rising costs of providing employee benefits. So I think it's a benefit for the employee as well as the employer. I want to thank you for asking consumers of the Oregon Health Plan for their input about changes to the health plan. We hope that the result of these hearings will be policies that allow people to use the services provided by the Oregon Health Plan more efficiently, thus bringing down the cost of health care for all people in Oregon. I'd like to present some of what works and what doesn't work with the Oregon Health Plan. For instance, community clinics work because people who have access to community clinics don't spend their entire eligible time looking for a provider. At this time, when people apply for the Oregon Health Plan, the application is so cumbersome. This 16-page application, and I challenge everybody on this committee to fill out this Oregon Health Plan application without help from Oregon Health Action Campaign's helpline, which is available throughout every day to help people fill out these applications. We've got, of these 16 pages that we have to fill out now, many states have shrunk that to one or two pages. It would take considerably less time for the workers who have to evaluate these applications and get back to people about their eligibility. Oh, wait, there's more. Yeah, another six forms we have to fill out there. Takes an awful long time, and it really takes a lot of time for the workers to go through and check every bit of documentation. It's not mandated, and it's really not necessary. Once people have jumped through the application process hoops, they then wait and are advised that they've been found eligible. That could take two or more months after their application is first received and their six-month eligibility meter is ticking away. This means that the enrollee has 3 or 4 months left in their six-month eligibility period to find a doctor who will take their card. Now, the card's been of continuing problem throughout the run of the Oregon Health Plan. It's a card the size of this paper. It's got valuable information encoded in it, very difficult to understand. And right now, since December, everybody's Oregon Health Plan card has contained some misinformation that has been a barrier for accessing services. It's acknowledged by the Office of Medical Assistance Programs that these cards are not being printed with the information that's going to help people determine exactly what their benefits are.
Mr. Chair.
It's in terrible disarray.
Thank you. Ms. Byers, explain to me what it is that is being misprinted on the card or not printed that makes
at this
really
time the card contains information about a person's eligibility. So from reading the card, you should know if any what managed care plan the person is on and what their copays they're expected to pay for what services, and again what's the package of benefits available to folks. It's incredibly difficult to read, and at this point it's actually got misinformation telling people that they are eligible for prescription services that they're not eligible for, or telling people that their managed care plan exists when it doesn't, so that people who are enrolled now, are paying premiums now, are not getting access and not being able to use the providers because the information on their card is not correct.
And a follow-up question, please. Did OMAP explain to you why that's the case?
Well, not to me personally, but I understand from things I've read that some of the problems result from waiting to see what happened with the ballot measure 28 and waiting to see if that how that was going to affect people's benefits, and at the same time adding into the mix the new Oregon Health Plan 2, which is very hard for people to understand, and now that's been overlaid with changes to Oregon Health Plan 2 that have come up in the last 2 months. So it's there's some computer problems, there's some information delays, and it's a difficult system when it works completely well.
When the system is working completely well, how often do they update the cards?
Everybody gets a new card every month.
Oh, every month.
It's a huge amount of mailing, and the cost of mailing, and when people move and their new addresses aren't recorded, that mailing has to be redone. And one of the biggest issues that we're dealing with all over the state with these cards is that plans leave and people all of a sudden are shifted into a new system of fee-for-service that they're not given instructions how to use.
Okay, I'm sorry that I interrupted. Did you have another question?
Well, no, I appreciate your question because I'm just sitting here, why on earth are we printing so darn much paper every month that nobody seems to understand? And I've had this complaint before. I don't know why we don't use something like an Oregon Trail card, which is a little debit card sort of thing, and just give you information on that.
Well, I came here in 89 from Massachusetts, where I had just become disabled from a stroke, and I had a card like an Oregon Trail card, but it was a mass health card, and everybody had one. And no matter if you had public insurance or private insurance, everybody had the same card. It really took a huge amount of the stigma of types of insurance out of the mix. And however, as you changed, I had been working for the post office, I went in, had a stroke, went on Medicaid. My card stayed the same. My provider stayed the same. I didn't have to wait for a card to show up every month for me to be able to access services for myself or my children. I think a trail card model would be really helpful for people. And it would also allow people to make changes in their information to when they move. Mm-hmm. If you add a family member or a family member is deleted, those kinds of things really impact the system and are very hard for individuals to impact.
All right, thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, let's see where it was. Well, I mean, so when we're talking about the application process and saying a enrollee has 3 or 4 months left in their 6-month eligibility period to find a doctor that will take their new card and make an initial appointment before they have to re-enroll and start the whole process again. In the case of managed care, the state begins to pay the managed care plan capitation, the monthly fee per enrollee, and yet the enrollee may never find a doctor, much less achieve an initial appointment throughout the entire eligibility period. Community clinics empowered by Medicaid money could start to provide preventative and primary care services as soon as the computer says the enrollee is eligible. That could be weeks before the paperwork shows up in the enrollee's mail. Another critical issue is overuse of emergency rooms. I know Ellen touched on that. But people who use Oregon Health Plan can tell you that phone-in advice nurses work. And you can get advice before you go to the emergency room. And the advice nurse can help you and enhance your ability to use services efficiently. People need a contact point that can give them information that can help them to use the services efficiently. I believe that exceptional needs care coordinators, or ENCCs, are provided by managed care organizations because the contracts they signed with the state require these organizations to provide one ENCC for some number of Oregon Health Plan enrollees in their managed care plan. Now, the state provides the client assistance services units within the Office of Medical Assistance Programs to address the needs of people on the Oregon Health Plan who don't have access to managed care, and they do it with 4 staff people. Doesn't even begin to be enough to be really an effective way to help people use the system and not waste it. The ENCCs have added incredible flexibility to the ways that individuals use their services to impact individual health. And we really believe the more the system offers supports that are less expensive than clinical services, the less expensive the system will be for all Oregonians.
I'm sorry.
Exceptional needs care coordinators. That's how we call them, ENCCs. We'd also like to suggest that savings could be realized by allowing specialists to act as primary care providers for people with disabilities and people with very specific health issues. This change in policy would mean that people who have to be seen by a specialist for specific ongoing care shouldn't have to spend hard-won doctor's appointments getting a referral to a doctor they have to see for their disability or specific health condition. Okay. Finally, I also want to say that people on the Oregon Health Plan are intelligent and articulate. Please continue to allow consumers of the Oregon Health Plan to be active in policymaking for this innovative and groundbreaking approach to health care access. Let consumers of the Oregon Health Plan share the challenges of the plan's future with their insight and experience. We can help make Oregon Health Plan stronger. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Okay, what I would ask of you, Elizabeth, is that you condense some of your suggestions that I can forward to the stakeholder group. I would really appreciate that. I think you have some good ideas there that they need to consider when they're looking at, you know, overhauling the health plan, making it more effective, and that's exactly what we're talking about in that work group. And there have been a lot of suggestions. I have not heard the ones, though, that I've heard today. And I think it's important that we have this input, and I will make sure that that is part of that group's consideration. So if you could, you know, just summarize the list that you...
Thank you, Senator Morissette. I'll make sure you get that summary.
Okay. Give it to Marjorie, and then she will distribute it to the rest of us.
Thank you.
Ellen.
Oh, I'm Ellen number two.
Ellen number two.
Ellen number one had to go pick up her son at preschool.
So identify
just so you know, I'm Ellen Gradison. Ellen Penny had to leave, though she apologized for that. I'm a staff attorney at the Oregon Law Center, which is a very small legal aid type organization. We were set up after Congress basically interfered with the way that traditional legal aids could operate. Traditional legal aids can no longer talk to the legislature in many ways. They cannot advocate for policies that might assist our clients in agencies and so forth. So the Law Center was set up in response to that. We're a very tiny organization. I also wear some other hats. I'm on the Governor's Public Health Advisory Board. I'm on the Access Subcommittee of the Oregon Health Council. I was a member of the Waiver Application Steering Committee. I was on something called the Basic Benefits Task Force, which either arose out of Health Services or the Oregon Health Council. Ellen Lowe could probably clarify that. I represent individual Oregonians with respect to health care. I filed suit on behalf of Mr. Watson and Mr. Papps last week in federal court in Portland. They are some of our residents who need really intensive services in their homes that have been cut off. So, lots of hats. My perspective, I guess, is a little different. I think that this revenue crisis is an opportunity to start over. I don't think the health plan, as it is existing right now, is working for a whole lot of people, and I'm not including just the people who are enrolled in it, but the providers, the state, and anybody else. I'd like to read a couple things. This is just a sentence from a study done by the Oregon Health Council. The role of healthcare safety net clinics in Oregon is the title. People may be enrolled in the OHP and yet do not always have access to a primary care provider. Provider reimbursement, malpractice insurance costs, health care workforce shortages, cultural and linguistic barriers, and other issues impact access to health care for all Oregonians, particularly people enrolled in OHP. So, another piece, this is from a study done at Oregon State University by OSU anthropologist Sunil Khanna. They've suggested that language barriers, immigration status, and a lack of knowledge about how the system works prevents many uninsured Oregonians from gaining access to the Oregon Health Plan. Many Hispanic groups in particular are perpetually uninsured, Khanna said. They don't learn about the Oregon Health Plan by reading the formal literature or visiting the website. They may not be able to read, or they may not have access to a computer. So they learn about the health plan informally through friends and family, and that word-of-mouth information tends to be colored by experiences that aren't necessarily positive. The health plan isn't necessarily working for its members, and it's certainly not working for people that aren't in it. I submit that if you build something, people won't come to it necessarily. And I want to include the providers in this too. I mean, we need to get real. I think you need to look at what is working. What is working right now, and Elizabeth brought this up, are the community health clinics. Now, they're also known as safety nets. I think that's a dirty word around here for some reason, and I don't know why. But you don't have a problem there with combating like a literacy issue or cultural issues. Uninsured people can use them. You don't have a citizenship problem. You know, many people in Oregon are not eligible for the health plan because they're not, their alienage isn't appropriate. They still may work here. They still support what we do in this state. I think we owe it to cover them. I think that there is data that shows that the community health clinics cost less. There's a study that was done that the Oregon Primary Care Association distributed OHP medical costs from July 2000 to June 2001. Pharmacy costs for FQHC's federally qualified health centers against non-safety net providers. Pharmacy costs per member per month for FQHCs were $24 and something, and for non-safety net providers in the 40s. Hospital inpatient costs per member per month, $37, almost $60 for non-safety net providers. The safety net community clinics, they know their populations, they know how to provide care, and they're more efficient. They also, some of them, I think most of them use a sliding fee scale. They're getting some money from people. They're getting some money from really, really poor people. So they're doing something that works. I would like to see us build on what we have, and that may be a start, and build something that maybe would begin to look like what the Basic Benefit Task Force came out with after months of discussion, which was a basic benefit. It was based on access to services. It wasn't an insurance model. It wasn't an asset protection model. It was based on access. So the uninsured could use it. Rural folks could use it. It solved many of the problems that we have right now. That's why I said it earlier. This revenue crisis is an opportunity. I think we should use it. I think there are a lot of very good things about trying to broaden health care. And the way to do it is not, in my view, and that's wearing all of my hats, by trying to hold on to something that isn't working for so many people. Now, we do have to keep our mandatory populations and our mandatory services. That's a very, very tiny group and a tiny group of services. I mean, we're used to thinking of OHP services. Mandatory services are very small. But that's a kernel that we cannot discard. That's federally mandated. Okay, so I'm not forgetting that. But I think there's ways to take that and craft something that people are already using and build on that to get to where we want to go, assuming that that's where we want to go. I'm willing to work with you in any of those capacities to get there.
Okay. Questions?
I have a question.
You know, we're struggling with a situation where it's not just government that doesn't have the income. We've lost at least comparable billions in the private sector, which is what actually figures in the loss of state revenue. And the question that I have, knowing that, how much more, and I'm not going to ask you to answer this personally, but how much more are you willing to give in order to do some of these things? Because everything that we've discussed here basically translates into more dollars unless we figure out ways to cut overhead in delivering those programs and turn around and utilize those to get more services.
Okay, Elizabeth mentioned one thing. If managed care plans, they're dropping out now, but when you pay cap payments to them every month for people that aren't using them, there's state money that's going right down the drain. That's one thing. Secondly, I haven't...
It isn't, because it's figured on an average of what's consumed, and because of that average, the other costs are cut. If you cut that capitation money out, they're not going to take care of the others and provide those services without those cap dollars. So that's just the same as they do when they pay a long-term care facility or a community-based care facility. They figure an average rate. And you can't say that the one that doesn't take quite that amount, you could take that away without then reducing what would make it possible for the other person to stay in that care. So the capitation, I disagree with you on that.
Okay. We haven't really talked about the revenue thing, but I think that we also need to spend as much energy as we have been trying to cut things, trying to build them up. And there are beer and wine taxes and all of there's lots of places we can go there that I don't think people are spending the same kind of energy there that needs to be spent. Yeah, you may be right on these cap payments, but the figures that I've seen from the safety net clinics are that their overhead, the administrative expenses, are smaller than a number of the large managed care organizations. I mean, frankly, I'd like to see the middleman go away altogether, but I don't know that we're going to get there. But I think it's something that's worth talking about because there's money right there that is not providing health care. Oh, and the administration of the health plan. When we talk about the cards, the 8.5 by 11s that go out every month, there's a lot of money that's going into that sort of thing. Which, again, if
sure. I'm not saying there isn't.
Yeah.
And when I've approached things, excuse me, we've been frustrated and have had to make cuts where cuts wouldn't have had to been made had administrative decisions been made differently. And that's been an extremely frustrating thing to me. And you're talking taxes. Basically, I don't care what form a tax takes that is initiated by the legislature. There are signatures collected and stopped and put a stop to that, basically, and the vote is taken. Now, you face an entirely different thing with the beer and wine tax that you faced with the cigarette tax for a number of reasons. There are far more people that utilize those products than utilize tobacco. So you've automatically got more people in favor of it than you have with the tobacco tax. They look on it a little bit different in that you can probably use those products within a reasonable amount and not hurt your body in any ways near as physically as you probably do with cigarette smoking, would be my initial feeling about that. And so how do you increase those type of things? And believe me, it's not a lobbyist thing. There was reference made on the Senate floor yesterday to the lobbyist control.
Yeah, I heard that.
The certain gentleman that was talking about that isn't the only one that doesn't accept money from those groups. It's not just a matter of that. It's a matter of basically how do you fight public opinion to the point where you get some of these things across that do answer it. Plus the fact that increasing the revenue does not answer then, and it puts off the answer that we're all trying to get at, is using the money more wisely. Because if they've got the money, it's going to be spent, and there's no incentive to make it do more with what you've got. And that's the problem I think that we face here. There isn't a credibility with the legislature right now because, and the management of the state agencies, because they've not been satisfied with the answers they get to where their dollars are actually going. And when you start criticizing some of the managed care units, not every managed care unit is a nonprofit agency. They have taxes, they have insurance, they have all kinds of things that you don't have at a state level where a public building is built. And basically all you have to do is maintain it. You don't have to worry about the capital investments and all those kind of things that you have to worry about on the outside. So I've always had a bone to pick when somebody says we can provide the service for X amount of percent of the overhead when they're getting all kinds of benefits and things in the background. And again, that's another thing that is bad about comparing church school or private school costs against it, because most of those arenas have people that donate that are not considered part of the tuition or part of the cost of operating the school, and so they donate buildings, they do a lot of things, they give property and all kinds of benefits that you don't get in a public school where you have to go out and buy it or tax people to pay for it. So you're kind of doing apples and oranges type things here, and you really get into the guts of the stuff that we're facing right now when we have to sit down and say, how do we go about working with what we've got? Because people don't have confidence in what we've done in the past. Our record in the last 10 years since I've been in the legislature is pretty horrendous when you come to government expansion. So we have been putting lots of money into some of these programs. Then I go back to my district and I find out that somebody was screaming his head off about getting cut off the Oregon Health Plan. Actually had VA benefits, and he's been sucking off the Oregon Health Plan for how many years? Allowing the federal government to get off of it when we're sending our taxes back to the federal government, not getting half of them back or not getting them back. So these are the problems that, you know, it's not just the programs out there that you want to support or want to see us support. We've got to have some help figuring out how we get to those. And we do have some bills coming that are going to look into making sure that people don't get on this program that don't really deserve to be on that have access to other means of.
Now,
I appreciate.
Now, wait a minute. Have three more.
I apologize, Mr. Chair, but this has got to be said.
I know.
Because we've got to come not just haranguing each other about what we're not doing. We've got to figure out some solutions to how we do it.
Okay. I took the liberty to invite six consumer groups who ordinarily don't get a chance to testify. I go to these workshop meetings and the stakeholder meetings in the evenings, and I do not hear from the consumer groups. And they are not making any progress. Believe me, they keep bumping into dead ends, and at some point they're going to come to some conclusions. And I think we have to have a broad discussion. So what I ask you to do is please give us some points, summarize some of your testimony, give it to us, and I will make sure that the stakeholder group gets that so that is on the record.
Can I make one comment? I would appreciate it if you would invite perhaps members of the Access Subcommittee, the Health Council, and Basic Benefits Task Force, who've already worked on a lot of these issues and discussed them and have reports to speak to you.
Okay. Okay, we've invited you today. We will do what we can to get as broad an input as possible, and that's all I can say. So I would appreciate if you could summarize your testimony, give it to us in writing, and I do appreciate it, and I do feel that the safety net clinics are a very vital part of our system. We did have Ruby Houghton here from the safety net group, and we had some testimony from them, and we will probably have them come back. So if you could do that, I would appreciate it. So we have three more individuals. Sheila North, would you please come forward? And Ellen Lowe and Lynn Marie Kreider. So, and if each of you then could give us your testimony. We're asking for about 10 minutes from each of you. And if we have questions, we will ask you questions along the way. So. And then I would ask each of you, if you did not bring written testimony, if you want to get something to us in writing later that we can include in that packet. And Ellen will be your representative at that stakeholder group. She is the consumer representative of that body, and she will, and I will both introduce your material to them. But I think it's important if you do have suggestions. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to leave at 2:30 because I'm going to a group where we're trying to figure out better management practices here that had to come in from out of state.
I know. I met with him this morning, and I know that you're going to be meeting with him this morning.
And I just wanted him to understand I wasn't cutting out here out of disrespect or anything.
Okay.
I just we're trying to pursue every angle we can.
Yeah, and the meeting that you're going to, I met with a gentleman, and that is an interesting proposal that he has, and that may save us some money, so I appreciate that. Jackie Mercer.
Oh,
Sheila.
I'm Jackie.
Replacing Jackie. You're replacing Jackie.
Yes.
Okay, Sheila.
My name is Sheila North, and I am vice president of ADAPAL, and that is the Administrators of Drug and Alcohol Programs Association of Oregon. I am also the executive director of DePaul Treatment Centers, which is an alcohol and drug and mental health treatment agency in Portland. We are one of the state's largest, I believe, and we serve people throughout the state, both youth and adults. I'm not here with prepared remarks because I am subbing for Jackie Mercer, but I'd like to share my concern that in the process that's occurring right now to plan or to revamp the Oregon Health Plan, that there is no representative at the table from the alcohol and drug treatment field. And I appreciate very much the opportunity to speak before you today, Chair Morissette, and the committee. When the Oregon Health Plan converted to Oregon Plus and Standard, and when the benefit for alcohol and drug treatment was eliminated to about 100,000 people who were in the standard population, a very effective system was dismantled. The people who are on OHP standard are generally youth from 18 to 21 and single people and people who are working poor or people who are couples without children. Amongst this group, there is a disproportionate number of people who are experiencing problems with drug and alcohol. In the sense that alcoholism and addiction is the number one public health problem we face in this country today, I believe it needs to be an integral part of the discussion and the planning and the benefit package that's available to people. During the when the Oregon Health Plan covered all people in a similar way, those people who had alcohol and drug problems were generally covered by a managed care plan, and the managed care plan covered their treatment, and it was a capitated rate often, but well controlled and very effective. A lot of people got treatment, and a lot of people were effectively returned to the system and became taxpayers and became effective members of society. By not having this coverage now, I think we're sort of saving money at the front end, but it's going to cost us money at the back end, because those folks who were qualified for the Oregon Health Plan and needed alcohol and drug treatment were often people coming out of the prison system and other kinds of people I described, mothers and fathers who were trying to regain custody of their children and needed to participate in treatment in order to demonstrate that they were committed to changing their lives. These are the people who won't be eligible for services. They, in effect, will, without this kind of intervention, I assume, end up back in the system consuming hospital stays, emergency room visits, and back in the judicial system, in the prison system, in the correction system. So I'm concerned that we are not saving money in our revamp of the system, but we're costing ourselves more money ultimately. And we are also losing, of course, the Medicaid match. So with the $2.2 million that was cut, the access to another $4 million or $6 million was lost. In addition, with mental health and alcohol and drug services being perceived kind of as a unit, I think we're losing the sense of the magnitude of the problem of addiction and alcoholism in our communities. There are certainly people who have mental health problems have are using alcohol and drugs at a high rate. Not all of them, but there is about a 75% 75% of people with mental health problems use alcohol and drugs, often for symptom control. The people whose primary diagnosis is addiction or alcoholism, that's represent about 3% of that population have mental health problems. And we're kind of focusing, we're looking at the problem through, it's my belief, through an impaired lens. when we think about the chronically and persistently mentally ill, we're talking about a group of people who have, who need a lot of services and are costing, and do cost, this cost taxpayers, cost the health plan money. But again, if there were preventative services available to them in terms of alcohol and drugs, it's less expensive. And I apologize because I'm not addressing things in a very organized way, but I think if I can leave you with one point, that is that there needs to be somebody talking about alcohol and drug issues. There needs to be somebody championing the fact that the system worked very effectively, that our outcomes were good and better than any other disease with a behavioral component like diabetes and heart disease, and that by not providing this benefit to the population in standard, we're ultimately going to cost our state more money, I believe. And that's the thought I'd like to leave you with.
Thank you. Questions? I understand the governor did not put the funds for alcohol drug treatment in his next budget. Is that what you understand? That we have no prospect for refunding those programs?
Yeah.
Okay. Again, if you have any, if you would like,
I will write something up and give it to Ellen.
I would appreciate that because we want to have that component in the summary that we submit to the work group. So I appreciate that.
Okay. Just as a public policy matter, I hope it will come to people's attention.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Ellen Lowe.
I'm Ellen Lowe, and I participate in health policy in Oregon, also implementation as a consumer member of Oregon's Health Services Commission and also the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And I should add that I was also chief petitioner for ballot measure 44, which raised the tobacco tax for back in 96. I've been part of Oregon health policy really going back to 1989 when during the legislative session we developed Senate Bill 27. Now, we didn't use the phrase evidence-based medicine then, but I do believe that was what we were really about. Our initial charge from 27 was to report to the governor a list of health services ranked by priority from the most important to the least important, representing the comparative benefits of each service to the entire population to be served. I believe it remains today a call to look at societal benefits rather than individual ones. And such a look demands listening to those populations to be served, such as you're doing today, coming to know the circumstances that surround their living and their working conditions. I do believe it demands looking beyond their common characteristics, and that's being poor and uninsured. And I hope that in the future we can begin to look at health status as well. Good health status is hard to maintain in an unhealthy environment. I'd like to begin to look at the condition treatment pairs and some of the expectations that some of us had when we first began the Oregon Health Plan. And I'll start with some of my disappointments, I guess, which include not achieving the employer mandate, that we never fully integrated mental health. We did not achieve parity. We have a long ways to go. I was one of those who thought that maybe the Oregon Health Plan would cover all public employees in the state of Oregon. And you have heard earlier today about the complex eligibility process. When we first started, it was far, far simpler. and the threshold was far easier to go over. We promised there would be fair and adequate reimbursement for providers. That has not occurred. And we looked forward to the participation from the private insurers in the state, and those have continued to fall away. And one of those things that really brought me on board was the promise for continuity of care. And we haven't made that either. But I do, however, continue to believe that the list, which in many ways is the core of the Medicaid Oregon Health Plan, a work of evidence-based medicine, is still a work of progress, and it deserves our continuing work. But I also believe some policy decisions have not allowed us to achieve its potential. And the list does give priority to prevention, but with the churning that is occurring, so often folks are not able to stay on the plan long enough to really achieve the benefits of those prevention services. And to me, one of the worst things was premiums, because I think someone who is below the federal poverty level, who is trying to maintain nutrition, perhaps a telephone, a place to live, that oftentimes then they would end up going bare. And what has happened is this leaves us then with a very adverse selection of those who, of the standard population, who have stayed with the plan. These are folks with chronic illnesses where it is important to their immediate survival to stay part of the plan. I do believe, and I think safety net clinics often have demonstrated this, that modest copays at times of service are far more effective in having people avail themselves of preventive services than having a monthly premium when you are as poor as so many of the standard folks are. I also expected the care contracts to be with the traditional insurers in the state. So folks would be able to move from the Oregon Health Plan then on to maintaining their coverage with the same insurer. Those insurers have fallen back, and now the plans are mainly community-based that are not part of the insurance market. But this is one of those times when what I expected maybe wasn't the best thing for these populations, because I do believe these community-based plans, whether they be Care Oregon or the one in Coos Bay that Bill Murray represents on the committee on which we serve, I think they provide services that are culturally and medically appropriate, and they are responsive to the populations within those communities. And I find myself speculating that if insurance regulations would allow, I have a feeling many of these folks, as they move into the workplace, would choose to maintain coverage with these same community-based plans that have been part of their OHP experience. And that is something that I think that it might be worth our while to look at that. Integration of mental health. I believe we made an error, trying to think, 93 was it, when we carved out about 25%, and we just have never then fully integrated mental health. And this may be one of the opportunities that is ours now as a result of the reevaluation that we're doing to see how we might be able to better integrate those services along with chemical dependency into fully integrate them into the Oregon Health Plan itself. So often when I encounter folks who are persistently and chronically mentally ill, I wonder what early diagnosis and intervention would have meant in their lives, the cost to them and their families, but also to us as the public. And that brings up another place where I think we could have a partnership, and that's with school-based health centers. We're in a county that, at least last time I looked, there are none. And they could be such a positive partner for the Oregon Health Plan. We have so few in Oregon, and oftentimes they have the potential to be a partner with safety net clinics. And I think of Cave Junction as one of those examples where you can have them working together. Just a few words about the list. It saves money. And we often hear people talking about going back to the old Medicaid. The list saves money. It also provides better services, I would say, appropriate medicine. Now, the Health Services Commission, on which I serve, we've been working with panels. We have added some practice guidelines. We're continuing to do more of that work. And some of you have been around know that in the early days, we were told implementation was not our business. But we really know that it has to be. And so that kind of work is proceeding, looking at step therapies within treatments. The list is not a static thing. I've heard a lot of discussion about how that the Oregon Health Plan costs are out of control. Well, I went back and reviewed what my husband and I are paying on our health care coverage. The Oregon Health Plan has not gone up as much in terms of costs as that which we enjoy. And I have a feeling maybe if the rest of you would look at some of your costs, you would have similar results. I came to serve on the Health Services Commission with a frame of reference that really is based in having done a lot of volunteer work in a health clinic, in a food pantry, in a soup kitchen. And I began to see such a strong relationship between poverty and health status, and that often the catastrophic expenses to some members of our population was what brought them to these charitable organizations for service. And those folks that I saw, many of them, most of them, are the ones that we now see as a population in the standard part of OHP. There were tremendous personal costs, but I think that we've also heard today there are some tremendous public costs as well. And so I leave you today with a plea that we not pull back from our commitment to this standard population. It was what made the Oregon Health Plan so important by reaching out to those who didn't find themselves in one of these categories that were defined by the federal government. You heard Ellen Gradison talk a little bit about the access or the safety net model that some of us participated in developing back during the waiver process. And I think there is a way by utilizing the community-based plans and then the safety net network, both the federally qualified and the others, and that we can develop an access model so we can be there when the standard population needs us. And when you talk about costs, I am convinced that the costs that society is going to accrue as a result of ignoring this population far outweigh what it would cost us to work on putting together this access model, safety net model, community-based, so it can really be responsive to the needs of the people who live within the area. And I do commit myself to carrying the messages I've heard today to that stakeholder group.
Thank you. Questions? The stakeholder committee gets so far, and then they kind of get mired down. And I think everybody agrees that the cost shift, and that's been mentioned several times, is going to be enormous, that we will pay for it somewhere, somehow. We will do that. So it's been, but anyway, I appreciate it.
And Mr. Chair, when you mention the cost shift, one of the things we did accomplish in, I guess, the second meeting was, at first the cost shift was just described as a cost shift to the private sector. We now look at cost shift in terms of the shift to all of us.
Thank you. Okay, Lynn Marie, you're up. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider. I'm research director at the Oregon AFL-CIO. We see the job of protecting the health care for our members and their families as a central challenge for us, and we also see ourselves as part of the larger problem of covering, or as a challenge to us is the larger problem of covering all Oregonians with health care. And for that reason, we have chosen to take a role in the discussions around the Oregon Health Plan. As some of you may know, I participated as a member of the Waiver Application Steering Committee along with Ellen Gradison and others that you've heard from today. Most of our members are not on the Oregon Health Plan. At the time that we talked about trying to expand coverage in the Oregon Health Plan to 185% of poverty, which seems like ages ago, although it was only 2 years ago, we believed that some of our lower wage members would become covered by the Oregon Health Plan. That's a dream that seems unachievable at this time, but the reality is that many people who work full-time for a living don't have health insurance in this state and don't have the means to pay for it. So I think ultimately we need to get back to that job of trying to figure out how to cover the working poor with health insurance. But right now I understand that part of what our, the major job in front of us is how do we retain what we have had in the Oregon Health Plan over the last several years. And we believe that the challenge to maintain services in the Oregon Health Plan is not entirely different from the challenge that we have to retain benefits in commercial insurance. And I think one of the things that I would like you to ask you to do as you think about what do we do is to think about in what ways is serving a low-income population different. And it is to some degree, partly because poverty is to some degree a health-induced phenomenon, and that we have a somewhat different higher needs population there. But also to think about where are we really seeing in the Oregon Health Plan the same problems we're seeing in the rest of the healthcare system. Because to the degree that we're seeing the same problems, we need to think about solutions that deal both with the challenges of cost increase in the commercial side and cost increase in the Oregon Health Plan. the written testimony I gave you is really just trying to go through a few, I think, false assumptions that sometimes we have relied upon to make policy, and then to move on to some suggestions for where we might best try to achieve cost savings in the Oregon Health Plan. I'll try to move quickly through the critique. First of all, I think there is an assumption that, by some, not all, that the problem is that Oregon Health Plan isn't run very well. And to be sure, in any kind of program, public or private, we're going to find things that we could do better. And I don't mean to belittle that notion. But the reality is that turning this problem over to the private sector is not a solution. And I haven't heard that so much, frankly, this year as I did a couple of years ago. But the trends in costs, as Ellen Lowe suggested, are very much the same in the Medicaid program as they are in the commercial side. And in fact, we're more efficient, sometimes in some ways that we shouldn't be, that is, that we're underpaying for what we get. But in any event, we are generally more efficient in public programs than we are in private. Second, there is an assumption sometimes that we can save money and cover more people in the health plan by increasing cost sharing while retaining the same set of benefits. And that was basically the, I think, false assumption that underlay the approach that the Waiver Application Steering Committee and the OHP2 process took, which was to impose cost sharing, increased premiums, increased copays as a way of sort of balancing the budget. Charging premiums to the poor simply means that the people that we enroll in the Oregon Health Plan are the people with immediate health needs, and that we don't enroll people who are relatively healthy, who we could prevent from suffering future problems if we were to provide that basic care. So we really undermined the Oregon Health Plan, and I think I'm repeating what Ellen said here, by establishing premiums that people who have to choose between food and telephone and transportation to get to the job and health insurance and don't have an immediate needs won't pay for. And similarly, charging to copays to people who are very poor don't do what copays are intended to do in the commercial market. In the commercial market, we use copays to try to incent, to discourage overutilization of services. But with the poor, a copay is more of a barrier than it is an incentive. And frankly, I could argue that copays don't work very well in the commercial market either. But that's not what we're here to talk about. What we did in the OHP2 process was to use copays and premiums as a way of sort of balancing the revenue. And that's not what those kinds of things should be used for. And they damage the program. Assumption number three, you can save money in OHP by lopping off whole categories of benefits that federal law doesn't require us to cover, and that's what we're doing as we don't pay for mental health, chemical dependency, and prescription drugs. We've had some discussion of that, and I won't take that one further, except to say that when we don't pay for categories of benefits for large numbers of people, we are not only making short-term savings at long-term expense to the public and as well as to people. But we're also destroying an infrastructure. This is not a switch that we can turn off and on. If we manage to recover from our current revenue crisis in several years, I don't know how we put the healthcare system back in place to deliver mental health services to people, because we will have destroyed it. The flow of money from Oregon Health Plan dollars was really necessary to keep that alive. Four, there's an assumption that I hear very frequently that there's nothing we can do about rising health care costs. They are inevitable because the population is aging, because of increased technology, whatever. We can't afford to believe that. It's pretty scary, given that the wages of working people in the last 30 years haven't gone up, but health care costs have gone up hugely. As a percentage of GDP, as you probably know, 1980 we were spending 8.8% of our gross domestic product on health care. We're now spending 14.1%, and the projection is for it to reach 17% in 2010. We can't go there. We can't afford as a society to go there. There's too much else that we need to be buying with those dollars. So we've got to think differently about that. The assumption that too many times the good people that believe that we need to take care of everybody, the assumption is you just pump more dollars into it, and I think we can't afford to go there. There's an assumption that you get what you pay for. And I would suggest to you that that's not always true in healthcare. Number one, what you pay depends on who you are in healthcare. So to some extent, those who can least afford to pay the most. And secondly, high price doesn't necessarily mean a better outcome from a health perspective. And I can't, you've probably been reading the same things I have over the last year, where we've seen that high expenditure, for example, Medicare areas of the country don't have people that are healthier than low expenditure areas.
Lynn, I just want to go back to the statement you just made about those who can least afford pay the most in health care.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I'm thinking in particular about prescription drugs, where the prices charged at retail to people that aren't insured are higher, and I have a chart that shows you on average.
I would agree with that, but that's a very slim portion of the overall medical cost issue. I think we have a larger shift to individuals who either private pay or private insurers who pick up a lot of the cost shift.
Senator Minnis, I would certainly agree that it's complicated in different slices of the different pieces of the healthcare system. The pricing works differently. But even in the commercial side, everybody doesn't pay the same thing. So I guess the only point I'm trying to make is one shouldn't assume that paying more is going to produce more in terms of healthcare outcomes, or that price is inevitable. But it works all kinds of ways. I mean, to be sure, on the hospitalization, the commercial side pays more than Medicaid, and there are folks that can't afford to pay it at all. My sixth point, I have a typographical error, but the corollary to the sort of assumption that you get what you pay for is that more healthcare spending is better. And I think we need to question that assumption, and I guess I moved into that a little bit in my discussion of the last. But the United States has by far the highest healthcare spending in the world, and we don't have better healthcare outcomes to Canada, the United Kingdom, so forth and so on. It ought to lead us to ask the question why. And to believe that there's a possibility of saving some money without doing damage to quality. And I think we have to challenge ourselves not to ask who should pay instead of me, but rather how can we pay less. And too often in the world that I come from, the employment world, we're having a fight between employers and workers about who's going to pay, when I think the question needs to be, what are we paying for, and are we getting value for that money? Is there a way we can do something to make this a less expensive product and yet protect people's health? And similarly, in the OHP, it's been, should the hospitals, should the providers take lower reimbursement rates in order to pay for this? Should recipients or Oregon Health Plan enrollees bear a share of the cost? How, it's been who pays rather than what are we paying for?
Lynn, I'm kind of fascinated by some of the things that you're saying. AFL-CIO Oregon, AFL-CIO nationally, it represents a fairly large constituent group, if I'm not mistaken, have a certain percentage that are unionized workers in government. Do you know what percentage that is in Oregon? What's your total membership in Oregon?
It's about AFL-CIO union members, about 180,000.
180,000, and of that 180,000, how many are public employee unions?
Boy. It's not half, but it's approaching that, probably.
Okay, so that means the other half, or the larger percentage, are unionized workers in the private sector. And my assumption is, correct me if I'm wrong, that those groups have health care coverage.
Most of them do, Senator Minnis. A few of our unions that represent low-paid workers have situations where the employee has coverage and the family doesn't.
Okay, so it's the employee only.
There is some of that. Not a lot. It's always been very important, both in the private and the public sector, for unions.
So help me, because we have several different issues that we talk about in this committee. One is Oregon Health Plan. I guess that's kind of the topic for the day, but I wanted to interject maybe from you. What are you seeing in the private sector side in terms of health care cost issues and inflation cost drivers? Because I hear from the business communities, and they're telling me that they're having a very, very difficult time getting a handle on how to control costs, much the same as you are. In fact, I hope that the chair would eventually bring the business community in to talk about those issues, because it seems to me that everybody on both sides of the equation are having the same problem. So do you see anything different between what's happening?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think we have to be sensitive to the fact that there are issues with respect to the low-income populations in the OHP, and I don't mean to belittle those, but I think much of the issue is the same. And we're seeing huge increases in the cost of health insurance, both for the public sector employees and private sector employees. And I'm saying the same message to them. We've got to think with the employer about how to reduce total cost.
Right, and that was my next question was, you know, whether there was a difference or not. But do you see any merit in some combination of MSA-type accounts and catastrophic health care insurance so that the employees, and I've heard this from some insurance carriers and some others, this idea that each employee, would have a certain number of dollars set aside that they would have the choice to see whichever practitioner they would want to see. They would pay for it with a card or some kind of a mechanism, and then you'd have a catastrophic health care plan overlapping that so that you had the employee had the capacity to choose where they went. Because, I mean, one of the backdrops of the problems we have in healthcare now is the collapse of the HMO PPO systems and the fee-for-service programs growing and the whole reimbursement issue. So to some degree, in an understanding co-pays and hearing from the insurance industry, you know, they seem to want to change the whole social structure of how we view health insurance as individuals and want more participation by individuals who have insurance with respect to how they make choices with respect to who they see and their own health care. In other words, make them more involved in health care. But has your organization looked at some hybrid model of MSAs and overlapping catastrophic health care, any of those kind of things?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, we have, although frankly our belief is that a more traditional kind of approach is better, because we want to have plans that encourage the use of preventive services and that provide, I guess, equal coverage or to people regardless of their age and their health status. So programs that have that only deal with the catastrophic or that allow choice and incentives to lower plans and so forth don't provide as good coverage to the older folks as the younger folks, and we'd rather have cross-subsidization, frankly, so that when you're young and you're in the workforce, frankly, your wage may be a little lower, your health care costs may be a little higher, so that the guy who's 55 and close to retirement, who costs more to insure, you know, is adequately covered. So we tend to think that what we need to do is strengthen the traditional kind of plan, frankly, to think about how could we have done, managed care was actually a good idea, and somehow it became a bureaucracy. Well, But we need to ask why, I think. Because the notion was that you try to make smart choices about how to spend money, that you provide some incentive in a capitated plan for providers to provide cost-effective care, which we don't have when we have that. And I want to get into this because I think part of our problem and this philosophy that we'll save money by getting the consumer more involved in health care, and that's sort of a code word in my experience for having the consumer pay a bigger share of the cost.
I understand what you're saying. I would hope that's not the objective. Let me kind of lean back into, and I said this in this committee before, the Portland Police Association, an organization I'm a member of, when they looked at healthcare utilization of Portland Police Association members versus those individuals who were in other positions, clerical staff, etc., they found that utilization was much less among law enforcement officers than they were in any other category. So their answer to that was, well, we want out of this group. Mm-hmm. We want to be considered separately because our utilization is less. We shouldn't have to pay more money. And that's a self-insured program, which is kind of interesting. So I would hope that if we're looking at MSA-type variations and models and putting choices in the hands of consumers, that we wouldn't be looking at it in terms of short-cheating, you know, the process. And one of the things that's an underlying discussion here is very few consumers know how much any particular procedure actually costs. And again, I've said this before, if I go to my physician for a physical, which I did in December, to find out whether I'm, you know, doing well or not, I have not a clue how much that particular procedure or exam would cost if I was a consumer making a choice. But I would submit that if I did have, as part of my portfolio, X number of dollars to spend, I might ask the question to my physician, how much are you charging me for this exam? And I might actually shop around a little bit and see if I can find a competent physician to do the exam for less.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think this is an important question because the whole question of if consumers knew better the cost, either because they had to pay it or because it was, you know, a sticker on the sheet when they went in to get service or whatever, that would make a difference, then that would suggest a certain kind of policy. My belief is that that most of healthcare cost growth is not consumer driven. Some of it is, to be sure. It is true that people see ads on TV for prescription drugs and they go in and ask for it, so there's some of that kind of pressure. But most of the choices about what gets spent in the healthcare system are choices that get made by providers because we don't know what we need, and we trust providers to tell us what we need. And I'm not suggesting that there's any evil intent here, but part of what those studies of comparative Medicare, you know, the outcomes were in high-spending Medicare regions of the country and low-spending told us is that the spending in those, the utilization of serious procedures, like, you know, heart surgery or whatever, were very similar across the regions. But there was a lot of spending for minor procedures, for diagnostic procedures, for office visits. There was a great deal of variability around the country. And what it tended to correlate to was what was the density, the high spending, was where there was higher density of hospital beds, higher density of specialist physicians. And so there were different practice patterns where those resources were available. And this is a hard thing to get a hold of, but what I'm saying is both in the OHP and in commercial plans, I think we need to start thinking about how do we either say we're not going to pay for certain kind of services, and that's the work that the Health Services Commission is doing and trying to refine the prioritized list, which I think is excellent work. And the other thing may be to think about how do we create incentives for providers? I think the disconnect that we have is not between the cost that of the service and patients, but between the cost of the service and physicians or providers. Because the insurance system means that neither patients nor providers have to care as much as we might like them to care about cost and whether a service really matters to people.
Mr. Chairman, Lynn, that's the whole point, isn't it? I mean, the whole point of having consumers understand the costs and make choices is to bring that out in the open.
But
to the participation of individuals in terms of copays is to bring that into the open.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnesota, what I'm saying to you is that it is more important to the total cost bill that providers understand what it costs and that we figure out a way for them to try to be, to not do the, not to order the test or the procedure that is not cost effective, because we rely on them
on
to tell us what's
on
necessary.
On that point, and you may very, very well be correct, but on that point, I do know that a number of physicians order additional tests and are extremely thorough because they're afraid of being sued. And that is a very real issue. So, I mean, on one hand, you've got the quality issue, but there are physicians that will go to maybe an illogical extreme in ordering various tests because they're afraid that their patient's going to sue them if something arises later on. And I'm talking to some practitioners who sue doctors for these things, that's one of the very things they go after. You failed to diagnose that I had cancer, or you failed to diagnose the following. Well, in the physician's mind, they're going to try to protect themselves any way they possibly can. So you can have tort reform that limits access to the civil justice system, which I wouldn't support in general, but maybe limiting frivolous claims, or somehow, you know, I guess giving the physicians the comfort level to know that they're not going to get sued. It's really a conundrum, in my opinion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I agree with you. We need to think about what is it that pushes physicians to overutilization, and I think one of them probably is what you're suggesting. One of them may be the sense that, well, the best way of diagnosing this particular, ultimately, the way we can be most sure is to use this particular test. But then maybe what we need is some of what Ellen is talking about, where you have steps, that you don't leap to that expensive diagnostic procedure if you may be able to solve the problem with a less expensive first step. It's complex. I'm simply suggesting that we need to think about how do we do it more cost effectively.
Then there's one other thing that you touched on, and that's the formulary, which tries to handle the cost of people like me who insisted that I get Celebrex that my doctor grudgingly prescribed and my HMO refused to give me.
Because it's a good drug.
No, it's not a good drug. After I took it, I realized it didn't do any good at all. But, I mean, I saw it on television, and so I thought, my gosh, I have to have that expensive drug. And my HMO was smart enough to deny it. But when I did take it, and talking to the representative from the pharmaceutical company, found out that it really wasn't for everybody and that it was great for certain things, but it's still on primetime television to order Celebrex. And I'm sure there are a lot of people rushing out and insisting that they get it. So that is a cost driver. Thank you for your questions.
Mr. Chair, may I just...
I think we need to address the insurance. I don't know, we'll tie it into the Oregon Health Plan, but I think that the business community, particularly the small business person who is trying to provide insurance and is caught in the squeeze, we will definitely hear, you know, from them.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's a relationship that is, I guess, an underlying premise in the Oregon Health Plan waiver. The FEOP program assumes that we grow and we expand the program, we do the subsidy program. There's an assumption that if you do grow that side, that you, by insuring more people, that you'll reduce cost shift to private payers and other insurance companies and all that kind of stuff. So I'd like to hear from some of these groups and hear what they have to say.
That's part of it. Yeah.
And I'd like to hear from Lynn, the FL-CIO. They've got obviously a lot of interest in the success of this program. So.
And again, Lynn, if you have some specific suggestions that you want to submit to the packet that Ellen will deliver to our work group, I do it.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think I have some quite specific recommendations in the second or the third and fourth page of my testimony, and I apologize for not getting there, because I know that's what you really need.
So the chair of the Education Committee is summoning me to join him next door, so I will have to end this very interesting session.